Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I just need to make the phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wondery Country, I'm Luke Sidham Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, the US and Iran reach a peace deal, but does it raise more questions than it answers?
Donald Trump has said deal. The Pakistanis have said deal. But it's important to underscore that this is an agreement that basically says, let's open the Strait of Hormuz and then start talking about the really tough issues. So this is just the beginning of what will be a long, drawn-out, difficult process.
That former Obama advisor is coming up. Then Switzerland knocks back a referendum to cap the country's population. What is behind that discussion? And it's been a huge weekend for Australian football. Australia topples Turkey in a historic World Cup opener. You'll hear from legendary Socceroo Craig Foster.
The Aussies have just shown the world, you know, what we're capable of. This was a day I'll never forget.
And also why the grey wiggle himself, Andrew Redmayne, has praise for one player in particular. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Hey, thanks for joining us for another week of The Breakfast Wrap. A big program ahead with news that the US and Iran have signed a peace deal. We woke up this morning to what began as pretty familiar sounds from the White House, the US president saying for more than the 30th time in just a couple of weeks that a deal with Iran was close, but there are a few things that were different this time around. In the last day, hours before this was meant to be signed, Israel launched strikes on Beirut. So in response, Iran said that crossed a red line and that attacks were imminent. So as we came on air, we thought we were about to see more tit-for-tat strikes. But then throughout the morning, breaking news from the X account of the Pakistani Prime Minister, Shehbaz Sharif. A peace deal had been reached between Iran and the United States. He posted online that both sides had declared an immediate and permanent termination of military operations on all fronts, including Lebanon. Now, pretty soon after, Donald Trump said that the US would cease its blockade on the Strait of Hormuz. Still, that left us with plenty of questions. What does all of this mean for global trade? What about Iran's nuclear program? And also, Israel's ongoing invasion of Lebanon. Israel isn't part of the deal, but apparently it encapsulates Lebanon. Our crack team got on the phones and locked in an interview with former Obama advisor, Professor Charles Kupchan. He's now at the Council on Foreign Relations, and here is what Sally asked him first.
Charles, we've almost been here before. Many times we've been told that some kind of peace agreement is imminent. Are we there now? Does this look like the real thing?
I think it's 90% solid because Donald Trump has said deal. The Pakistanis have said deal. But it's important to underscore that this is an agreement that basically says, let's open the Strait of Hormuz and then start talking about the really tough issues. So this is just the beginning of what will be a long, drawn out, difficult process.
Mm. Where does all this leave Israel and Lebanon? We've seen an angry phone call, another one, from US President Donald Trump to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after strikes on southern Beirut. Some analysts have actually said if we see further these strikes at the last minute, that is an indication that a deal is on. Israel's doing what it can do before there's some kind of agreement.
Well, I would say that there are two big threats to this agreement sticking. One is the core issues themselves, and it's completely conceivable to me that when Iran and the United States start talking about disposal of Iran's highly enriched uranium, suspending further enrichment, controls on Iran's ballistic missiles, they don't find common ground. And then the other problem is that war continues on other fronts. Israel, Gaza, Israel, Lebanon, Houthis launching missiles against Israel. This is supposed to be a full spectrum ceasefire that includes Israel and Lebanon. Let's see where it goes. I don't think the Israelis are very happy about this ceasefire. I don't think they want Lebanon to be included because Benjamin Netanyahu is headed into an election later this year. He's got unfinished business on every front. Hezbollah continues to launch missiles and drones into Israel. So it's going to be hard to kind of keep this ceasefire between Iran and the United States going if we see more and more fighting between Israel and Hezbollah.
Charles, as we're speaking, well and truly is breaking news unfolding. As we're speaking, Reuters is reporting now that Iran's deputy foreign minister says they will enter negotiations after unfreezing of assets, end of blockade and end of war. What do you make of those remarks?
That is, I would say, a bit of a cold shower on the deal, because the United States is not going to unfreeze assets before there's progress on the underlying issues. I think the nature of this deal is, let's get the strait open while we begin to talk. But the main source that the United States, the main source of leverage the United States continues to wield is the economic sanctions, their ability to strangle Iran's economy, the fact that there are billions of dollars in Iran in assets frozen in foreign banks. So there's no way that Trump can afford to start the flow of money to Iran without getting significant progress on the nuclear issue. And that is going to take weeks and probably months of negotiations. Worth keeping in mind that the nuclear deal that Obama negotiated took over 2 years. So the fact that the Iranians are saying, we'll start talking after our assets are unfrozen, that says to me, we may not be there yet.
Professor Charles Kupchan there, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former advisor to Barack Obama on European policy. Well, overnight, Swiss voters rejected a proposal to limit the country's population to 10 million people. The proposal came from the right-wing Swiss People's Party, which has long campaigned on an anti-immigration platform. The current population in Switzerland is 9.1 million people, and according to government data, that has ballooned in the last couple decades, and 27% of them are not Swiss citizens. We wanted to unpack the detail around the vote and how such a referendum actually came about. We invited on Geneva-based economics professor Cedric Thiel, and he explained just what had happened.
So it shows that Switzerland, where there was a very active debate on this referendum, actually made a decision that, yes, there are challenges with a fast-growing population, but in the grand scheme of things, these challenges comes with also good aspect of prosperity, and we decided to accept them, and also not to jeopardize our relationship with the European Union.
Has this been a difficult debate in Switzerland?
Yes. To put things a bit in long-term perspective, so we regularly have votes about immigration and foreigners. In fact, that goes back already since the 1960s. And there is a party, actually the biggest party in Switzerland, always pushing this and always with a theme that problems come from immigration. So there are problems coming with a high growth of population, which is coming from immigration, such as, you know, high housing prices, congestion in public transport. So these problems are real. However, the solution just to say, oh, we should have fewer foreigners and that will be the magic wand, is actually way too simplistic. So there are better ways, more complicated ways, but actually more efficient ways to handle these problems.
And Professor, can you tell me more about this system in Switzerland? Rather than the government making its own decisions about immigration, why is it that the way that it's usually done is via having a referendum?
So what there is, if you get enough signatures from the population, that's usually couple of hundred thousands, you can propose a change to the constitutions. So this can be done by a political party, it can be done by a group of citizens. All you have to do is come with a number of required signatures, a proposal to change one of the articles of the constitution, and this is then put to a vote. We vote on such things about four times a year on all kinds of topics. And to have this change go through, you need to have the majority of the people, but also the majority of the states, what we call the cantons. So you need this double majority to make a change to the constitution. If such a change is accepted, then it's the job of parliament to adjust the law and basically implement the change that the population and the canton have decided.
And the people in Switzerland, this large group who are not Swiss citizens, mostly where are they from?
So we are in Switzerland, a fairly high proportion of people who are not Swiss. You know, one thing is important to remember, these are not foreign-born people. You have people who are not Swiss, but have been living their whole life in Switzerland. And in many cases, their parents lived their whole life also. So you can have people who have been in Switzerland for two or three generations, well, not with a Swiss passport. Getting a Swiss passport is actually quite tricky. So that explains why we have a relatively large proportion of foreign nationality people. The second aspect is we have free labor movement with the European Union, even though we're not a member. That means that someone from the EU can come to Switzerland. Now, there are requirements that they need to have a job. So it's not like you can come here and go collect unemployment benefits or such a thing. And this has led to a fairly large increase in population growth since 2007. Mm-hmm. Switzerland is an economy that's doing well. Unsurprisingly, this motivates people to come here.
And that is Geneva-based economics professor Cedric Thiel talking about this referendum in Switzerland that has failed to limit the country's population to 10 million people. Well, before we get to the Socceroos, there is another spectacle in North America, this one set for the lawns of the White House. The president is holding a UFC cage fighting match outside his official residence, in part to mark his 80th birthday, but also tying into celebrations marking 250 years since the Declaration of Independence was signed. Now, things may have changed by the time you hear this, because we've just seen an alert from the US National Weather Service that DC is actually set for really severe thunderstorms today. So potentially a dramatic cage fight in the rain? I don't know. Can you even do a UFC fight in the rain? Whatever happens, we wanted to know how we got to this point. That is the question that Sally asked investigative journalist Karim Zidane, whose upcoming book actually looks at how mixed martial arts transformed from just an athletic practice to now a multi-billion dollar corporate enterprise.
Oh, well, that's a big question. I'm going to try and sum it up as succinctly as I possibly can here. So this event is mutually beneficial. For Donald Trump, this is an opportunity for a president who has, in his second term, really pushed aggressive politics, both foreign and domestically. I mean, this is a president who wants to present himself as a strong man, who operates with the ideology of might is right. And to him, to someone like that, what better sport to place on the lawns of the White House than a UFC cage fight? So the symbolism here is perfect. For Donald Trump, this is a propaganda spectacle and a birthday bash all in one go. So a massive PR opportunity for a president who's extraordinarily unpopular. And for the UFC, well, this is an organization that has moved from being an ostracized league that was banned in 36 states, right, really almost regulated out of existence by Republicans, to now basically the new American pastime. This event proves that the UFC has become an integral part of Donald Trump's administration, of MAGA politics in general. And this event exists now because it's a reward from Donald Trump to the UFC for helping him return to the White House.
Karim, in journalism, we often follow the money. What do we know about how the Trump family may be enriched by this event and some of the enterprises surrounding it?
Well, Donald Trump himself has taken out stock in TKO, which is the organization that owns both the UFC and the WWE. So he himself is looking to benefit from this. The UFC has entered a sponsorship agreement with World Liberty Financial, which is a highly scandalous entity that operates the Trump family's crypto schemes. And they intend on paying out bonuses of $250,000 in crypto to UFC fighters on the card. Of course, there's the patronage system that really is not discussed enough here, and how much the UFC itself is also enriching itself from this. It has entered new sponsorship agreements on the backs of this event, including an agreement with a very controversial defense tech company called Enduro, which sort of is trying to transform how we operate in warfare through AI and autonomous drones and sentry towers that surveil the border, etc. These are the entities that now work with the UFC. So both Trump and the UFC are enriching themselves and benefiting tremendously from this.
Last week, the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, signed a memorandum of understanding with the UFC to create a public-private partnership. What do we know about this deal, and what's the government doing having a deal with a cage-fighting entity?
I am so glad you asked this question, because honestly, this news has gone under the radar. Truth be told, this is, I believe, the next stage in the UFC-Trump relationship. For many, and even for me for a while, I thought this UFC-White House event would be the culmination of this relationship, as sort of as high as it goes. But what I've come to realize is things such as this memorandum of understanding signify a more formal integration of the UFC into American politics through initiatives such as sports diplomacy, which suggests that the UFC will actually be a factor in U.S. foreign policy moving forward. Now, truth be told, this is speculation at the moment, because the memorandum of understanding itself and the live stream offered very little nuance and information as to how this exactly will integrate. But suffice to say that this is one of many examples of the UFC being formally integrated into the government. Another one, to quickly mention it, is the UFC has signed a deal with the FBI to actually train FBI agents as well in MMA and combat. So we're going to be seeing a lot more of this.
Karim Zidane there, an investigative journalist for Sports Politica, with a forthcoming book titled In the Shadow of the Cage. Well, we are finally here. It has been a truly remarkable weekend for Australian football. Socceroos fans probably waking up with a bit of a smile on their face today after the best start to a World Cup our men's side has had in 20 years. Not since we beat Japan in 2006 have we won a World Cup opener. Now, there is a bit of controversy this morning, because despite defeating Turkey 2-0, the Turkish captain, Hakan Çalhanoğlu, has stood by his pre-match comments that his side would dominate the Socceroos, saying that they still did.
You said yesterday that Turkey had a more talented team and they didn't dominate this match.
We didn't dominate?
No, I think you did on possession, sure.
I don't think they did the same like you, because everyone see that we dominate today. I think we did good game. Just what we didn't do good is that we didn't score.
So what do we think about that? Yesterday I was actually down at the Fed Square fan site as thousands of other rowdy Socceroos supporters and Turkish fans also cheered on their teams. And after our remarkable win, I got some thoughts from the former Socceroo captain, Craig Foster. It was the first time in decades he wasn't actually watching a World Cup game from inside a broadcast studio. He was down there hosting the live fan site, and he told me what he made of Australia's detractors, like Çalhanoğlu, who discounted us even before we hit the pitch.
Well, the Aussies have just shown the world, you know, what we're capable of. Every Australian knows, but, you know, sometimes we're not ambitious enough as well on the world stage, you know, and our politicians like to say, oh, we're small, they like to keep Australia small, we can't make an impact, anything, we shouldn't do anything. And Tony Popovich said, no, that's not going to happen. We're going to play a 20-year-old Burundian refugee kid who we love. We're going to put a kid young player in goals, who's hardly played for Australia. You know, we're going to put Ocon Engsler in midfield, who chipped the ball beautifully over for the first goal. And he's shown bravery, you know, in his selections and in the start of the game, going at Turkey, who thought they were going to dominate us. Well, you know what, Çalhanoğlu mate, you guys dominated the ball. Yes, they had a lot of it, but we dominated the goals, mate. So what do you want? Because that's what football's about.
Your voice is raspier than usual.
Oh, no,
you're usually locked
anymore.
in a broadcast.
That's right, that's right.
What's it like to be among the fans?
No, it's fantastic because, you know, you like, we have to be kind of sane on air, and we, you know, we have to try and find the right words, and often you can't say what you really want to say because you just like burst out swearing or, you know, just like jump up. So it's been a beautiful day for me. I've never had the opportunity. I've seen all the videos. I know how passionate our community is, but this was a day I'll never forget.
The team put out a video talking about the migrant backgrounds of a lot of the players. What do you think about the message this team is sending to Australia?
It's important that the face of Australia is represented through the national team, you know, and we've got, I think, 8 Australians in the squad of African background now. That shows that, you know, changing demography of Australia. We're missing a few, like Asian Australia, Indigenous Australia. There's no one in the squad this year, so that's really disappointing for us. It doesn't matter what your political view is, and geez, there's a hell of a lot of political fighting in Australia at the moment, but you saw everyone down here of all political persuasions, of all cultural persuasions, all ages, all genders, doesn't matter, mate. You know, we're all football, and isn't that a nice message for Australia?
And that is ex-Socceroo Craig Foster there, having a chat with Radio National Brekkie yesterday at the Federation Square fan site after our monumental win. And you can actually hear his reaction to Australia's first goal if you listen back to today's episode of AM on ABC Listen. Our colleague Ollie Gordon was standing right next to him when we went one up. Well, one of the heroes of the game was Australia's goalie, 22-year-old Patrick Beach, who made 8 saves. Now, back in 2022, Australia's hero was 4-cap Socceroo Andrew Redmayne. His goalkeeping antics earned him the Grey Wiggle nickname, but more importantly, they secured Australia's spot at the Qatar World Cup. He joined Sally this morning for a chat, and he gave us his assessment of yesterday's performance.
Yeah, I thought it was a kind of astute kind of performance that was resolute, that I guess kind of stems down from Tony Popovich himself. He was that kind of player. He's that kind of manager. And we just looked kind of almost impenetrable at the back, and we absorbed a lot of pressure. Like Fozzie just mentioned, we didn't have too much of the ball, but I thought we were extremely clinical going forward.
Mm. What's it like trying to get the balance right with young players? Some of the young players can be overwhelmed by this kind of big occasion. Others, they're so young, they're almost fearless about what they're going into. How difficult is it to tell whether a young gun is good to go?
I don't know. That's probably a part that's it's probably a bit higher than my pay grade. So, you know, that's why Tony's making the decisions he made. But having worked under Popper, I know he'll make a decision and he'll stick by it, and he'll kind of die on his own sword. But having said that, there was certainly some eyebrows with his selections, but they paid off immensely. I thought Patrick Beach was absolutely phenomenal in goals in his World Cup debut, but I think only his 3rd cap from off the top of my head, which is phenomenal. It's it was certainly a goalkeeping display that was far kind of greater than his in his history in the green and gold jersey.
Yeah, Patrick Beach, he made 8 saves, which is the most of any Australian goalkeeper in a World Cup match. You know what it's like to be standing in front of the net. Mentally, that's a big day out.
Yeah, huge day. I think if you just took his whole performance into perspective, it was assured, it was resolute. I think barring one kind of errant long kick in the first kind of 10 minutes, other than that, every pass, every action really hit the nail on the head, and he looked completely assured in goal. So I dare say it's going to set up a massive game against the US.
That's right. So next weekend we are taking on the United States. How do you regard their team and their chances? What do we know about them?
They've been up and down in friendlies leading into the World Cup, but again, it's kind of a result that shocked me when they put 4 past Paraguay, who was a very defensive team, and they kind of opened it up a bit like butter. I mean, they've obviously got a lot of quality on the ball, and they've got some players playing in big leagues around the world. But at the same time, they seemed kind of effortless. So I think, two wins from US and Australia, it certainly sets up a mouthwatering clash.
And that is the Grey Wiggle himself, 4-cap Socceroo Andrew Redmayne there, talking to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. Well, thank you so much for listening. The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Oscar Coleman, and I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. See you tomorrow.